And welcome, popcorn junkies. Welcome, film lovers, film fans, aficionados, film buffs, geeks, whatever you are. This is your one-stop shop for movie reviews, trailer reactions, streaming reviews, movie news, you name it. Come here. Do subscribe if you haven't. This is a review of a British movie called Scrapper. Scrapper is the directorial debut of Charlotte Regan. It's her first feature-length film. It stars Harris Dickinson, who you will probably know best from Triangle of Sadness recently, a very capable young actor. And it's interestingly, it's shot. The director of photography on this film is Molly Manning Walker. And the reason that's quite significant is she is also the director of the soon-to-be-released How to Have Sex, which I believe won a certain regard at Cannes. And we're all extraordinarily excited about that film. So this is a British film. It's sort of coming out of what I would describe as a sort of, it's almost like a new sort of social realist, but social magic realist genre. In fact, that's what I think it might be, a social magic realist drama, British social magic realist drama, bloody hell, in which, you know, films are parked or set within the sort of, you know, extraordinarily sort of, not bleak, but incredibly tough, real life sort of estates, suburbs, neighbourhoods of urban cities, London principally. I'm thinking of like Rye Lane here, How to Have Sex, likewise. It's about young people, but young ordinary people, not young middle class people, not young privileged people. It's kind of the social realism of today, but they have a sort of heightened sensibility. There's a film literate kind of approach to them. You know, Rye Lane was a recent film full of, you know, really primary colours, shot principally obviously in Peckham, Rye Lane, Peckham Rye. But it was a love story, and it utilised all sorts of kind of little motifs and choruses, you know, characters kind of talking into camera and all that kind of stuff. Well, this film isn't entirely dissimilar to that. Perhaps another film that this maybe references out to is After Sun, the recent Paul Mescal film about him as, you know, sort of absent father on holiday with his daughter, obviously split up with her mother, and it's about their sort of estranged relationship of sorts and how they manage it on a holiday. Well, this also is a father-daughter film. It's set somewhere in London. It's socially realist based. I mean, it's almost like, you know, there's the Ken Loaches, there's the Mike Lees. We have a long tradition of social realism in cinema. And as I say, this is kind of the next sort of generation, if you like, coming through, and they're having fun with the medium of film. And so in that sense, this is almost a little bit of a kind of Florida Project, that American indie film, sort of, it's flicked through in its cinematography with a sort of sense of the Florida Project in terms of the sort of primary coloured kind of, you know, exteriors of houses and interiors of rooms and the production design and set design and room design and all that kind of stuff. It has a lightness of touch. And what's the premise? This is a story about a young girl, Georgie. She's played by Lola Campbell. I think it's her first major role. She plays a young girl who's essentially looking after herself. Her mother's died. She's keeping herself going within sort of her flat. She's got sort of clearly ridiculous. And I think this is something that's quite important to kind of tackle in this film. It asks us to stretch the envelope of believability. You know, for example, she keeps social services at bay because she essentially is living on her own in a flat since her mother's died. And she keeps social services at bay by going to visit her local corner store. And the guy there, she gets him to record single sentence answers to questions, and then she phones the social services, and when they ask questions, she plays his voice. It wouldn't happen in real life. And I think, you know, at first, as I was settling into this film, if I had to struggle with it, my struggle was at the beginning was in terms of believing the premise, believing the conceit, believing the idea that this girl really could have got as far as she had got for even a day or two in a flat without picking up the fact that her mother had died. So there was a believability factor here that I did struggle with somewhat. She has a close friend in the block of flats that she lives with, that's a neighbour, and they go and they steal bikes. I mean, I was also getting that sort of Italian neorealist kind of reference out there, the bicycle thieves. You know, the title Scrapper, it's established quite early on. She's a scrapper. She's a fighter. She's got strength. She's got metal. She's got, you know, she's fierce. She's got a kind of edge to her. She's got a cheek. She's got a nouse, and she's got a front. There's a really neat little scene where she's sort of like caught almost stealing a bike with her mate. And she then goes into a process of sort of explaining to the bike owner, well, actually, you know, I was checking your bike out for kind of, you know, you need to get this sorted, you need to get that sorted. She's got the gift of the gab and all that malarkey. But this isn't based on reality. You know, one of the things I did struggle with at the front here was, and it's about the first 20 minutes, 25 minutes, where we establish her sort of routine. We establish the fact that she's kind of got pinned to the wall, a sort of regimen, if you like, a list of the 13 stages of grief, I think, and she's almost ticking them off, which I thought was really sweet. You know, she's parenting herself, which I think is a really sort of, you know, sort of poignant detail. That said, I think by 20 to 25 minutes, it had kind of run out of steam. It had kind of exhausted its ability to lean on Lola Campbell. She was good, and she gave us the sort of range that we needed. But it was beginning to feel a little bit on one note, which is kind of good, because it was at this point that the character of Jason, played by Harris Dickinson, comes into the film, literally climbs over a fence at the back of the flat, and he's her father. He's her father. And what proceeds is, really, it's a sort of almost a duologue film, which I love. I mean, the last short film that we made, The Gangbuster, was essentially a duologue. And this is kind of similar to that. It's a duologue between a father and a daughter, an estranged father with his daughter. He's come back. You know, he knows that she's died, her mother's died. And he tries to sort of almost, you know, enforce a friendly, paternal, fatherly role on her. And of course, it's the resistance he meets, it's the resistance between the two of them. She's kind of rebellious, but at the same time, she's intrigued in this guy. Again, you know, the magic realist aspect of this film, there are moments where it will kind of suddenly shoot off to a chorus, if you like, a sort of Greek chorus of kind of spiders in close-up talking about what's going on with little kind of speech bubbles. Very sweet, very nice, potentially clever idea. It didn't work for me. It was a bit too twee, and it was a bit too kind of too left field for me. I think one of the difficulties with any of these kind of films, when you live in South London, when you see South London, when you know how harsh actually the streets of South London or certain parts of London can be, and having grown up in those streets too, albeit in the 70s, it's kind of hard almost to buy the filmic innocence that's presented in this film sometimes. It was a little bit of my problem with Rye Lane. I get what's happening here. I get they're trying not to do... It's not about keeping it in a sort of poverty porn zone. But I think like a film like The Selfish Giant does a very good job of parking it in reality, but you get the sort of the fizzy innocence and joy of childhood and tragedy of childhood in there too. And I just at times with this film felt that it was a little bit too stretched away. It was almost a sort of... I'm not saying it is a middle-class filmmaker, but it was almost a sort of film school student's version of South London, or a child who was living on their own in an estate in South London, rather than the sort of reality of it. Whereas I said, I felt something like The Selfish Giant. If you haven't seen it, please check it out. It was a really authentic portrait of two kids literally scraping and scrapping around for money for their families and what have you. But within it, there was also comedy too. So things like the spiders didn't work, but things like the set design did work. And Harris Dickinson really, you know, I wasn't entirely convinced by him in Triangle of Sadness. I don't necessarily think it was his fault. He was playing a sort of one-note, slightly shallow kind of model character. Harris Dickinson in this is absolutely sensational. And what happens here is, it's a big ask to ask of any young actor to carry a film. And Lola Campbell does a really good job, I think, of carrying the first 20 minutes. And that's as far as she could get it really on her own, I think. And at the point that Harris Dickinson comes in, a really neat buddy movie type thing kind of creeps in, a sort of acerbic kind of relationship. I mean, I was getting almost memories of, do you remember that Ryan O'Neill film, Paper Moon, where I think he comes back, doesn't he? Her mum's died, and there's a sort of, he senses there's an opportunity there or something. I don't feel the Harris Dickinson father in this is cynical, but he has come back and he wants to strike a relationship up with her. And what's interesting, of course, about the father-daughter relationship in this is that he's almost the same age as her. I mean, obviously he's not, he can't be. But, you know, in terms of, you know, it could be like a young sister and an older brother talking. He's very young. And their relationship on camera is absolutely sensational. It's the meat and veg of the film. I mean, it really is. Them riffing together. There are little moments where I feel that improvisation was encouraged, where they're kind of voicing, you know, commuters on platforms and stuff like that. After Sun with Paul Mescal did it very seriously and in a very sort of, well, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, quite a depressing way. This was quite a sing-songy process of watching a father and daughter slowly come together. There is a question mark about how drawn to parenting and being a good dad would a young man such as Harris Dickinson in this film be. But I think in that sense, that's where these films do need to take a little bit of a kind of fairy tale step. And that's why I think by the end of this film, I felt much more comfortable with this kind of unbelievability, if you like, because what it is, it's a sort of romantic sense of, wouldn't it be nice if absent dads took this decision to kind of want to be in their kids' lives. This is about single parent kids. This is about children who don't have parental guidance. This is about, this encourages you to ask questions about what is the role of a dad? You know, to what extent can a young man overcome his own masculinity and step towards the responsibilities of being a father? It's also that wonderful thing, a little bit like Your Mum, My Dad, is it? Or My Mum, Your Dad, that dating series. You know, the ways in which youngsters can often know more than adults about certain things. And in this, there's real sparring between actually the street wise smartness of the kid, Georgie, played by Lola Campbell, versus Harris Dickinson's perplexed kind of, but I'm your dad and I'm this. And so there's the sort of almost inherent childlike stupidity of being a boy, which is well-meaning, but makes mistakes. And then there's the sort of inherent maturity, if you like, of a woman, even in the form of a 12-year-old or 11-year-old girl. The title Scrapper plays on so many levels, which I really like. Obviously, she's a scrapper, she's tenacious, she's a fighter and all that kind of stuff. It's also about her holding together the scraps, if you like, the memories and pieces of memory that she's got of her mum, holding them together and pulling together some kind of ability to grieve and feel grief. And then, of course, they're living off scraps. You know, she's quite literally scraping together and finding scraps to make her life, you know, to be able to sustain herself and look after herself. And so in that sense, it's a buddy movie. It's a sort of modern day Paper Moon. It's very light. It does, as I say, test the edges of believability. I did find myself thinking, this is incredibly twee. This bears virtually zero relevance or relationship to what it's like to live in London. But maybe that's not necessarily the point. Maybe that's not necessarily the point of these films. Rye Lane, incredibly sweet. Rye Lane was like a sort of before sunset kind of moment set in Peckham Rye. You couldn't walk around Peckham Rye in that sort of blithely romantic fashion. But hey, that's what the movies are for, right? It's to kind of allow us to envisage and see and test drive and entertain and toy with kind of, you know, idealized ideas of life. And so this is an idealized little portrait of a father-daughter relationship renaissance, like Rye Lane was, of romance happening within Southeast London. So in that sense, I think they'd make a really nice double bill. It's the sort of much more light-hearted end of father-daughter films, whereas After Sun is a much more sort of dour, darker, quite troublesome and traumatizing portrait of a father's disconnect with his child. This is a film about making connections. If I was to score this film, it's always so brutal, isn't it? I'd probably give this film, I don't know, 75 out of 100. It's, you know, it was nice. It was nice. But it didn't really, really get mucky at any point. I felt it was a bit too easy at the edges. I felt that some of the issues that she would have faced were too easily sort of fudged. And I think, you know, in the real world, this, it just wouldn't have been like this. And I think the challenge with a story like this is to achieve this sort of magic realism in that sort of Kes-like way, you know, get to the truth of innocence and childlikeness and humour. There's an inherent humour to all children. The Selfish Giant is a really good example. And yet at the same time, keep the innocence, keep the fun, keep the sort of lightheartedness, if you like, keep a lightness and romantic touch to things, but also park it in a much more real, sort of relatable world. I think that's kind of what I was after a lot more, rather than such a romanticized vision of sort of, you know, urban London housing estate life. At times, I think this film just got slightly caught up on thinking it needed to be a bit more sort of self-referentially clever and funny for the sake of it. And I think some of those kind of talking head moments into camera by the sort of, you know, the teachers and the bike, the woman who bought the stolen bikes off them, it didn't really gel. So that rhythmically, that didn't really work. So, you know, I could see what it was striving for and it could have got there, but I don't know. I just think I actually think this film needed to park itself in a slightly more real landscape, and you could have still allowed the sort of Paper Moon-esque kind of buddy movie, sort of, you know, relationship building, companionship, kind of camaraderie between the two of them. I think you could have still built that in a nice way. But, it, you know, look, it's a really sweet British film.